All right. Wait. United States Prison Bills for Veterans Plans is now in session. General Amanda L. Meredith presiding. All of our business before this court draw near, and you shall be heard. God bless the United States and this honorable court. Please be seated.
Good morning. I am Judge Meredith. To my right is Judge Toth, and to my left is Judge Lauer. We are here today in the matter of Mayfield versus McDonough, docket number 21-8176. Will counsel please note your appearance for the record, beginning with the movement's counsel.
Douglas Brzezinski for Mrs. Covington, who is a motion to become a substitute.
Thank you, counsel.
Nicholas Esserman, on behalf of the secretary,
Thank you. Each side will have 30 minutes to present their arguments. Counsel for the movement, do you wish to reserve time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor, I reserve 10 minutes.
Okay, thank you. We'll make that happen. Counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. We are here today because a simple matter of substitution under the court's Rule 43 has expanded into a morass of technical and procedural defects that have severely impacted Mrs. Covington, who is the granddaughter of the veteran who has passed since he filed his claim, and the substitute of his wife, her grandmother, who has also passed pending resolution of the veteran's claim. I believe it's important here to understand a few basic facts which either the Secretary has failed to mention in his brief or has still not fully recognized. Mrs. Mayfield, the grandmother, substituted in at the regional office level, at the administrative level, and filed for accrued benefits, a claim for accrued benefits. She was accepted as a substitute. Mrs. Covington, who is now seeking to become the substitute for the grandmother, is the second substitute, operating under the law that allows substitutes for substitutes. All of this came about because of the previous laws that limited the ability to substitute or to obtain any accrued benefits past 2 years. That case, the Bonnie case, resulted from the misinterpretation of a statute, the statutory requirements, and resulted in 5122.
So, Mr. I mean, I understand it's procedurally a little bit complicated or technically complicated, but why not just file the form? Why didn't your client just file the accrued benefits form?
Well, because, Your Honor, A, the form is not required. B, a form already has been filed and is indeed the form, the application that was denied by the RO and the board, which is before the court on the merits. So what the secretary wants is to file another form for the same benefit, which is already being adjudicated on the merits before this court. And secondly, Mrs. Covington form could not file within 1 year of the veteran's death, as is required by law. Her application should be immediately denied. The veteran died many years ago. So I don't understand why or how that form would do anything more than check a box in the secretary's requirement list, which, by the way, there is no requirement for this. The statutes do not require an application for substitution. They're separate statutes. So anyways, to file it is futile and a waste of time. And it's not necessary.
I mean, the Federal Circuit hasn't noted that it was futile. I mean, in the merit case, I mean, they dismissed the case largely, you know, as moot because standing hadn't been satisfied because the claimant hadn't filed an accrued benefits form.
Because there was no accrued benefit form. She was the first substitute. There was none filed. There was none in the record. This case, that merit case, very familiar. It's distinguishable.
But the substitute has to prove eligibility as for accrued benefits. So it's a condition precedent.
That's a very good point, because does she have to prove eligibility or does she have to establish that she's eligible? For example, I am now eligible for Social Security because of age and work history. I haven't applied. I'm still eligible. She may be eligible. She is eligible. She has provided a receipt that's no one's challenged to this court.
Right, but I mean, that's how fact-finding operates, is you have to prove the status.
Yes, Your Honor. And I also would say, please remember, we filed a motion under your court's Rule 43. All of this about 5122A, 5121A, and 5121 has nothing to do with this court's motion. This is all arising because of what I consider dicta in Breedlove, that this court is not allowed to do the basic fact-finding of whether someone is eligible, in this case, simply whether a receipt is valid or not. All the other horribles may or may not arise somewhere else, but it doesn't arise here. One document, unchallenged, that unequivocally establishes her eligibility under 5121, even if that's what the standard was. It is not. The standard is whether she's the appropriate individual. Same receipt reasonably establishes that. The court's fact-finding in this, I submit, to determine whether a receipt is valid, is no different at all than what this court does every single day in EJID determinations. When a submittal is made for expenses, there are receipts. This court does not provide those receipts to the secretary and ask. The reason is there's fact-finding that is prohibited by 7252. That is fact-finding related to the board's decision. This has nothing to do with the board. We'll never go back to the board. We'll never have come from the board.
I mean, under that argument, I'm just kind of tracing it out here. What if the secretary conceded substitution and we denied it? Because that seems to be suggesting that we have this free form, you know, we can kind of do our own de novo fact-finding here.
Well, I do believe for the court's rules, the court does have a certain amount of fact-finding authority. You do not turn over the rules to the secretary and ask any compliance with any other rule. Indeed, here the secretary is saying, because of this fact-finding statement in Breedlove, that not only does he get to determine who can be before this court under Rule 36, you, the very court whose rule it is, has no authority to review that decision. And it's clear from Breedlove and all the cases, Merritt, this is a standing issue. There is no authority for the secretary, a party, to have authority to determine who the other party is. Indeed, I would submit, respectfully, that's an abandonment of your jurisdiction, your authority, to determine who appears in front of this court. Again, all of that is a sidelight. We applied under Rule 43. She is an appropriate person. That's a yes or no for the court.
Counsel, could I interject there? You've suggested that this receipt that Mrs. Cummington has submitted to VA is sufficient. On the form that VA has asked her to provide, the 21601, it requests additional information, it appears to me. And if you have it in front of you, that form, box 16, asks, have you been reimbursed from any source for any of the expenses paid from your personal funds? Has Ms. Cummington provided that information to VA as to whether she used her personal funds to pay the $640 to the funeral home, and whether she has been reimbursed from any other source for those expenses?
Not to my knowledge, Your Honor, but I will also caveat that it has nothing to do with substituting before this court.
Okay, if I could, though, if Ms. Cummington hasn't even alleged, or there's nothing in our materials that suggests that she's out of pocket the $640, how is there a live case or controversy here? What would she be seeking reimbursement for from any amounts that were due to Mrs. Mayfield or to the veteran? if she's not out of pocket.
Well, Your Honor, she provided the receipt. If there is additional fact-finding, ask for a briefing. Ask for that information.
Okay, do you know the answer to those questions? Has she?
My understanding is she paid out of pocket. She was the surviving.
She's
grandma.
Not been reimbursed.
No, she's not. To my knowledge, she has not been reimbursed.
So it's your view that she's at least alleging, even though it's not in our materials, that she is out of pocket.
Correct.
$640.
If I may, substitution. She gets to come into this court and resolve the pending question of accrued benefits, because that's the issue before the court. Was the veteran properly denied? And if it was Mrs. Mayfield, the wife, that would be the question before the court. We would have resolved that months and months ago. If it's negative, if the court finds there are against her, there's no accrued benefits. We wouldn't be applying. If there are, there's already an application in front of the VA for those accrued benefits. The substitution only puts Mrs. Mayfield Mrs. Covington in the shoes of Mrs. Mayfield. She gets the entire record and she can litigate it below if necessary, further if the court rules a remand versus an award or substitutes. Only substitution has nothing to do with reimbursement, whether it was 1 cent is all she needs to prove. If even 5121 applies, we know 5121 big A does not apply because that's what Breedlove said. And indeed, that was the issue in front of Breedlove, not fact-finding and all that. So again, I believe, similar to what happened in the Freeman case, you've got a case where there's some dicta. People have run with that and well beyond what it was intended to be.
Counsel, if I could, are you conceding that Ms. Covington has not filed an application for accrued benefits and did not do so within the 1 year after Mrs. Mayfield's death?
That's true.
And that's who she's seeking to substitute for, is Mrs. Mayfield.
Or Mrs. Mayfield for the veterans' benefit.
So what authorities do you have for the notion that Mrs. Covington does not need to file an application for accrued benefits, that she can rely on Mrs. Mayfield's application when, as Judge Toth pointed out, there are different legal bases for their potential entitlement to accrued benefits eventually?
Once again, Your Honor, I would say at most, this is a question that may or may not arise after she is substituted and after the courts determine the merits. There is no requirement under your rule to file anything other than a motion. You have to first determine whether she is the appropriate person. Having the receipt, makes her at least an arguable person for the court to consider. And unless you find other reasons not to appoint her, to put her into, substitute into this case, all the rest of that is the secretary's morass, which we can discuss if you want, but it is not relevant. I submit.
How could she, getting back to where I started, in order to eventually receive any funds that were due to Mrs. Mayfield or to the veteran, wouldn't she need to have applied to receive accrued benefits?
No.
What authority do you have for that notion that the person who would eventually receive the funds doesn't need to apply for them?
I submit there's no authority that says she will not or cannot. There is an accrued benefits claim pending before this court, much less the VA. Let's resolve it. That issue, if it is an issue, and there's no authority other than the secretary's misreading of 5121 big A and 5121 little a 6 that says that. There is no authority that says you must.
I mean, it's been stated over and over again, so it's a non-controversial proposition that claimants' benefits die with the claimants, right? A party's claim for benefits dies with them, and then accrued benefits is in substitution are ways around that. And so we have two deceased parties here, but in both cases, I mean, those claims deceased with those parties, and now Ms. Covington would have to establish independently eligibility for benefits. But benefits don't pass. I mean, that's a non-controversial proposition, unless there's they have a legal justification for passing. That's what basically accrued benefits are.
Your Honor, I agree with your conclusion. I don't agree with how you got there. Veterans' benefits used to die with the veteran. That's the whole Bonnie issue and the issue of why we have substitution. Substitution is a law. It is not a way around. It is a direct method that Congress intended that the veterans' benefits do not die with the veterans, particularly because of stuff like we're going through now, where it goes on forever and people die. And it used to die. It used to end. Nobody got a dollar. That is exactly why we have this now. And what we're doing now is dragging it into the third generation. I will repeat, and I believe this is critical, nothing in your rule requires this. So whether the answer is yes, and she's never going to get her benefits, has nothing to do whether she can get in front of this court.
But I guess the difficulty, I mean, our rule, you know, appellate courts generally, our rules are always about standing. It's not a merits determination as to whether somebody satisfies the elements. And so, I mean, I think we put it on the merit. I mean, it's just a procedural rule that allows for basically someone to satisfy standing and the case to go forward.
And that's exactly why I submit you cannot allow the secretary to decide that issue. Forms, no forms, you cannot allow the secretary to stand up here and say, Mrs. Covington cannot substitute in this court. That's what they've said, minus all of her. And you can't review that. How can a party determine who the other party can be? You have to answer that question. That's the root of this before you get into any forms, any information.
If we were to conclude that Ms. Covington did need to file her own application for accrued benefits, and you've conceded that she did not within a year of Ms. Mayfield's death, then does merit control, is this moot because she could never be entitled to a payout of accrued benefits?
No, I think merit only established that there has to be an accrued benefits application in the file, in the matter. There is an accrued benefits application. Substitution means
not from Ms. Covington.
In the shoes she steps into, substitution means nothing if you have to redo every filing in that claim form. Does she have to file the original 526 for the veteran? Does she have to do every single form that was submitted by Mrs. Mayfield? Because if that's the case, every substitution will require a blizzard of reapplications, exactly the opposite of what's required. Actually, 5110 statute, Congress explicitly said she's not required to file anything to get the benefits. And yet we're still talking about which forms, how many forms, what forms. We filed the correct form for substitution. The FAST letter 1030 discussing substitution explicitly states this is a form that's acceptable for substitution. The other ones are as well, but this one specifically. The VA's instructions on the form entitled Application for Benefits Upon Death of a Claimant explicitly says this is for substitution. There is just, it just changed. Now file this form. Do we need to file a burial form? Because she may need it in the future. We need to find, what other forms do we need that might be needed in the future? If I may, one intriguing point here is that the statute says who would be eligible. That is an English construct meaning future in the past, something that would happen in the future that's expected to happen. The Secretary's regulation at 1010 says is. They expect it to have happened. That is a not subtle difference. That turns the whole thing on its head. You have to be eligible. You don't have to apply. It's expected you will apply, but in this case, there's a lot of things between now and when that you would have to apply, even if she does. So I can conclude briefly. This court is asked to focus on its rule and its authority to determine whether this receipt is a fact that would impact the board or the fact that the board has made or not. If it's not, then the court certainly has authority to look at that, whatever evidence is presented. If it's too much or too much detail, they can say so, but a simple receipt is no different than EJIA, no different than deciding whether an NOA was filed on time, no different than deciding whether a brief is 30 pages or 2 pages too long. If you decide you cannot look at this one receipt, then you got to send every EJIA application to the secretary to find out whether those are valid, that's valid receipt, and whether the total is valid.
See, you're asking us to overrule Breedlove.
No, Your Honor. I'm asking you to look at Breedlove and see that that is dicta, in that that point was not necessary to decide the issue before the court, which was whether 5121A applied to the court or not. We don't dispute. We think it's a correct answer. 5121A does not apply to the court. That's why you have the rule, okay? And the rule, if it doesn't apply, why are we applying it now? Why are you applying it through the back door? The court makes its own rules, and it's beyond my ability to describe that how the judge, the secretary's position, that you can't even review his determination on your rule.
Excuse me, counsel. Don, please add 3 minutes.
So, Mr. Brzezinski, may I ask you a question?
Yes, Your Honor.
Please confirm whether or not Ms. Covington has appealed the AOJ decision regarding substitution?
No.
Okay, another question. So the VA FAST letter 10-30 that you referenced, that was rescinded as a result of incorporating that guidance in the M21.
But at the time, coincidentally, that was issued the same day as Breedlove. So the discussion, it colors what they meant. The FAST letter, I pulled it off a month or two ago. It was still available, and it says what it says. So that was the interpretation at the time, at least. It's not, you know, it's not binding on the court.
But the question is, at the time that Ms. Covington submitted her application, the FAST letter had been rescinded as a result of incorporation into the M21, correct?
I believe that's correct. But the M21 still also states that this form is for substitution. And quite frankly, why have a form for substitution if you can't do it? Get rid of it. Just say accrued benefits. I mean, the instructions say what it's for. The vacillator said what it's for. The title says what it's for. And then they pop up with a new requirement. And again, none of this has anything to do with the court's Rule 43, which maybe there's not case law. This will be it. But I just, again, submit the court, I think it's not a close call that the court is the ultimate arbiter of its own rules. Any court is. And just to show the lack of merit to what's going on here, for the secretary to say, no, you can't even review our determination of your discussion of who is the appropriate person. Appropriate person doesn't say per 5121A. You decide who's appropriate to at least pursue the case in the court. If we lose because we didn't do something at the agency later, that is not the merits of the case. Any further questions? I'll reserve the rest of my time.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel, for the secretary, you have 3 additional minutes if you need them. You may proceed.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. This court in Breedlove provided a framework for ruling on motions to dismiss, or excuse me, motions to substitute, I apologize. That's been in effect for over 10 years. The court recognized its discretion to permit substitution, but concluded that it must first obtain a determination from VA about whether an eligible accrued benefits claimant is available. And that, the court noted, was a factual determination best suited for the secretary. To obtain that determination, the movement must submit an application for accrued benefits to VA. Now here, the movement submitted a request for substitution. I think there is a little confusion about substitution for the agency and the difference between that and substitution for this court. and was subsequently informed on three occasions that the proper form to determine eligibility for accrued benefits is an application for accrued benefits. Now, despite these requests, the movement did not submit the application for accrued benefits, and the request for substitution was subsequently denied. Compounding matters, as Judge Meredith noted, applications for accrued benefits must be received with 1 year of death, and that 1 year period passed for the movement in January 2023. Because VA has denied the movement's request and her status remains legitimately in dispute with the potential to be appealed within VA, the court should deny the motion, vacate the underlying board decision, and dismiss the appeal, consistent with the framework in Breedlove and the recent decisions by the Fed Circuit and Merit.
So, counsel, I have a couple of sort of process questions for you. So do ROs always adjudicate substitution when the matter's pending before us? Something always goes to the RO, or, you know, if the evidence is clear, this is the surviving spouse, and I mean, or can another agent like Group 7 or something stipulate to it?
Your Honor, my understanding is that we always reach out to the ROs to have that determination made. And just to clarify, you know, Breedlove lays out that it's eligibility for accrued benefits. And so the application for accrued benefits is what we're generally expecting to receive to make that determination. And that's our position here.
Yeah, I mean, I have to beat you up a little bit about that because, I mean, I've been a lawyer for a long time, and even I found this a tiny bit confusing that you have a form for substitution for which I guess a condition precedent is you also submit a form for accrued benefits. I mean, I can imagine non-lawyer widows finding this a bit confusing. Why not just why not change the substitution application so that automatically includes all the information for accrued benefits?
I can understand that concern, Your Honor, but ultimately those forms are a construct of 5121 and 5021 big A. And so the request for substitution contemplates 5121 big A, and that is limited to the extent that somebody is not one of those first three or four priority people listed.
I mean, you can see the optics aren't great here, right? I mean, there's a form for substitution, and then all of a sudden there's kind of a gotcha, like, oh, turns out there was an additional form you had to submit within a year. You missed that, case over, sorry.
Your Honor, I would submit if we had not informed the movement on multiple occasions that the correct form or the form that we needed to continue to process eligibility was the application, then that would be problematic. But the request for substitution was submitted, and once we noticed that we were trying to determine eligibility, determination for accrued benefits, we did request that form, and it was never submitted.
Okay, so you said the process is pretty uniform, that all of these are routed through the RO. The RO makes basically an accrued benefits eligibility determination, and then the kind of substitution that goes forward or is denied at that point.
Yes, sir.
Can it then be appealed? Can somebody appeal that to the board?
Absolutely, Your Honor. The determination that was made here has appellate rights and in the modern system, so also supplemental claim, higher level review, or appeal to the board. So it's appealable as any, same way as any RO decision under the modern system.
Okay. And you made that note, I mean, does that happen? I don't think I've ever seen
it. I mean, when I was looking at the Memdex from this court, I mean, there has been situations where this court has dismissed based on a denial of eligibility before below, and I suspect that in some circumstances those are appealed, but I haven't personally seen one of those situations. There, any other questions?
Yeah. Can you explain to us what the process is at VA when there are these multiple substitutions? Because here we have the veteran passed away, then his surviving spouse passed away. Now we have the granddaughter trying to substitute for the grandmother. So what is the process? Does VA have internal guidance or regulations that explain what happens in the sequence?
I'm not familiar with any specific guidance or regulations that deal with kind of that unique process where we're on the kind of the third, to borrow a term, generation of claimants. But we do submit that the movement here also needs to prove eligibility to accrue benefits under Breedlove for substitution purposes before this court. And so they don't necessarily step into the shoes of Ms. Mayfield here because she filed a timely application. Each subsequent potential accrued beneficiary needs to establish eligibility on their own standing. And that's what we're lacking here because we don't have an application for accrued benefits.
And what's that? Are you relying on just 5121 to come to the conclusion that both Mrs. Mayfield and Mrs. Covington would have needed to file their own application forms for accrued benefits, or is there some other authority you're relying on?
Those statutes, Your Honor, if I recall, the language in the statutes refers to claimant and not veteran, and so the way movement seems to be appearing to interpret those, at least those statutes, to the extent that they're relying on them, is that the veteran is the one that subsequent accrued beneficiaries are stepping in for. But here, it's the claimant, Ms. Mayfield, who the movement is attempting to take from, for lack of a better term.
Can I get you to respond to the conversation I was having with counsel for the movement about case or controversy? So it appears that Mrs. Covington has submitted this receipt that she did pay money to a funeral home for her grandmother's funeral. Do we have any information in here as to whether those payments came from her personal funds or whether she was subsequently reimbursed by anyone? And do we need to know that to know if there's a live case or controversy here? How could she get paid back if she's already been made whole and it's not out of pocket? Is there a live case or controversy here, or if we don't know?
There's no record here, so we have the same information that you have in that receipt that was paid to the funeral home. I'm not aware of any evidence that she has been reimbursed for those funds or that she used her own personal funds. But I think that point speaks to kind of the reason we have the application for accrued benefits. It's not only determines whether somebody bore those expenses out of their own pocket, but also it speaks to whether there are potential other eligible accrued beneficiaries who could have a higher priority under 5121A than somebody who just simply bore the last expenses. And that's also part of the determination that the RO makes to see if there's any other people who might be interested in any potentially available accrued benefits. So that is why that application is important, not just to kind of have those factual matters determined with respect to how the expenses were paid and whether or not they're reimbursed, but also to identify other interested parties.
Thank you.
No question. So the secretary here is asking the court to vacate the board decision. And if the court were to do that and the VA ultimately accepted Ms. Covington as an accrued beneficiary, what would the process at the agency look like in that case?
Well, if the court was to vacate the board, the court was to find that there wasn't a determination as an eligible accrued beneficiary and vacate the board decision, the decision's being vacated as to Mrs. Mayfield. And that's how the court's case law considers that under Breedlove. If the movement was to appeal the denial and also be successful on that appeal, that's obviously a situation that Breedlove doesn't necessarily contemplate, and I suspect part of the reason why we're here today. The solution that I think we would suggest, and I think possibly with the court, if Mrs. Covington is successful down below, then possibly she could petition this court to recall a mandate and see if she could pursue the merits of the appeal given the change in her status. But unless and until that happens, that's an open question. But I will note that the hurdles, as Judge Meredith acknowledged, is that the application hasn't been received within a year. That's a statutory deadline. So the merits of any appeal down below are questionable.
And this is a bit speculative, but if that were to happen, where would the board likely place her on the docket?
Your Honor, as I'm sure you're familiar, the board places appeals as they receive them. There's been no appeal filed yet, and no appeal filed to the board. There's other appellate avenues available to the movement as well, whether that's higher level review or supplemental claim. I don't know how those actually function in this context, but those are available to her. But she would be docketed in docket order, and it would proceed in the course of the board's normal business.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. If I could just briefly conclude, we just ask that you deny the motion to vacate the appeal and dismiss the appeal. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Counsel, your rebuttal.
Your Honor, if I may, in Breedlove, Judge Tope, it says, therefore, we now hold that based on enactment of 5121A, big A, a veteran's Chapter 11 disability benefits claim survives the death of the veteran, not for the purpose of providing VA benefits to a veteran, but for the purpose of furthering the claim of an eligible accrued benefits claimant. So again, I don't believe that we've skirted the dies with the benefit. It is no longer the law that benefits die with the veteran under the conditions. And again, we have an accrued benefits claim. It is before the court. If I may also call the court's attention to HR report number 100-963 at page 26. The creation of this court is intended to provide a more independent review by a body which is not bound by the Secretary's view of law, permitting an important procedural rule to be enforced or waived at the direction of the Secretary could lead to an appearance for litigants that this court is not independent, but that the Secretary remains in control of the litigation. This is what is going on here. It is standing. Substitution, Breedlove says, is standing. No party has the authority, right, or power to tell this court someone cannot appear before it. And if this court gets into the 51, doesn't need to get into the 5121, little a, big A, which form, whatever. We have put a motion before the court that Mrs. Covington is the appropriate individual to continue the case in front of the court. That is it. If we get beyond that, then we start calling into question who can be before this court is determined by a litigant. That's it. There's nothing further to be said. To the extent that the court is concerned about Breedlove and the issue about fact-finding, fact-finding in Breedlove is dicta. If you don't believe it is, it certainly didn't go to the next level of analyzing which facts this court can review. There are a number of cases which allow limited fact-finding, jurisdiction for standing, for a lot of things, including EJIA, which is the direct corollary here. And I don't know how you separate that out. If you say that that receipt cannot be reviewed by the court to determine the appropriate individual, I do not know how you distinguish that from an EJIA case where I submit my bills for the hotel.
But I mean, like, our facts finding EJIA is binding on the agency, right? I mean, what would happen here, say, what would happen if two claimants, two movements, both sought substitution, and we had to sort of decide who had kind of superior rights, right? And we had to determine who was a proper, you know, which one was properly eligible for a credit. Would that be a favorable finding that would then be binding on the agency?
I believe so. As a matter of fact, I want to be specific on the relief we're requesting here. Is that the court?
Again, if we're just deciding for the limited purposes of standing and under our court rule, we're not touching 5121.
It's an ancillary issue that is solely within this court's jurisdiction to decide. You're the deciders, as they say.
Yeah, but as to our court's rule, I mean,
that's right. If you want to truncate it there, that's perfectly acceptable and reasonable. But as far as they have made a finding here that you need to submit another form and that there's no evidence, and even if there was, there's a substantial dispute here. That's one of the rules here. And they're saying the court doesn't have the authority to decide the dispute. I say now that it's before the court, you can say Mrs. Covington has met both the court's rule and the statutory requirement, and she should be, if accrued benefits are awarded by the court in the merits, she is an adequate substitute under 5121 big A as well. And we ask that you do that. The receipt is all we need. This case, other cases may present other issues. There is no one arguing that I'm third cousin and I paid for some medicine. None. There isn't. There hasn't been. Now they come in late. That's an issue you can take. You have discretion, Breedlove explicitly says, which is part of the internal conflict. The secretary, Breedlove is the secretary that's veto and then says it's our discretion. You have discretion to turn away anyone. I would hope that the discretion wouldn't be abused by saying, no, that receipt is fake, or that receipt is for medicine, who knows what it was. This is for the funeral of a woman whose name appears on that, paid for by Mrs. Covington, whose name also appears on that. The only way she is not the appropriate individual, the only question before the court, is if you find that faked. No evidence.
Okay, so you mentioned this before, and I always struggle with this a little bit between accrued benefits and substitution. But I mean, what's the practical benefit here to Ms. Covington to substitute it over and against just kind of starting a new filing accrued benefits form? You know, there's no adverse VA decisions. What's like what's
5 to 6 years going through the board? That's what substitution is all about. All the history of the substitution, and I won't quote it here, congressional
You can't fast-track that under it.
Your Honor, I would have a much larger 401k if we could figure out how to get through the board in less than 5 years. It is impossible. That is what is going on here, is that the Secretary always wants stuff thrown the other side of, you know, back that way. We're here. We're here. You can resolve every single thing now that this motion has become a substantive issue. You can decide the merits. You can decide that Mrs. Covington is the appropriate substitute to receive the merits decision, and she's the appropriate substitute to receive the accrued benefits approved and ordered by you. You can order that. All this noise about you can't. They've raised the statutes. She meets the statutes. It's now before you. Are you, you know, if you want to say she isn't the individual, the appropriate individual, you can do that. But there is some reasoning, I would hope, beyond just that Secretary says no. And that's all there is right now. They have not commented on the merits. They have not commented on the receipt. They have not claimed she's not eligible. We want another form. That alone deserves a precedential decision to say, if you demand a form and the form says what it says, you got to do what it says. You can't just, okay. This happens all the time, by the way. I'll just, outside, it's very, very frustrating because this is what goes on. We want this form. I know it, very well-known attorneys who filed 2 and 3 forms for everything because they filed one and got told to file the other. They file the other, they get told to file this one. So now they just file them all. And that is kind of what some of us predicted would happen with this form stuff. It's got to stop. You've got a widow who has lost her husband. You've got a granddaughter who's lost both grandparents. Oh, send us more forms. Sometimes it might be required. Don't get me wrong. When you got 6 cousins, 2 daughters, and a son all fighting over grandpa's benefits, there's a reason for it, perhaps. Perhaps if that was this case, you could say that's fact-finding for the board. This is not fact-finding for the board. You've got the receipt, they've got the receipt. Is their decision in this case even reasonable? That's what I would submit. And again, we asked the court, Mrs. Cumming asked the court, to allow her to approve her motion to substitute in this court under its court's rules and to order her submission as a substitute below based on the arguments of the secretary and the receipt, the undeniable eligibility for under 5121 little A6. There is no reason that shouldn't be approved now and save the woman another 3 or 4 or 5 or 6 years. And we could submit a form, I guess. I don't know what we put on it because all the information is there. It's just one of these rote, unreasonable, congressional-defying processes. Congress did this to make it simpler. Is this simpler than what it used to be? No. I'm here, you're here, for all this, or to just say, oh, that's a receipt, we'll process your claim. With that, I thank the court. Unless there's any other questions.
Thank you, counsel. The case will be submitted for consideration. The court is now adjourned, and we will come down with counsel.
All rise.